This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise. Brand, one of the fathers of the green movement, stirred up controversy when he began advocating for the expansion of nuclear energy. When he topped that with an unexpected position on genetically modified organisms, he called into question fundamental assumptions that underlie environmentalism itself. This week on Sea Change Radio, we continue our discussion with Stuart Brand, an American writer best known as the editor of the Whole Earth Catalog. He founded a number of organizations, including The Well, the Global Business Network, and the Long Now Foundation. His most recent book is Whole Earth Discipline, an Eco-Pragmatist Manifesto. My guest today on Sea Change Radio is Stuart Brand. Stuart, in your book, Whole Earth Discipline, you cover a wide range of topics, including the debate on nuclear energy, which we've already touched upon. And also, you take an unorthodox approach to genetically modified organisms, or GMOs. But really, the precursor to a discussion on GMOs is one on how humans interact with and manipulate nature in the first place, I think. Am I right about that? I mean, this would include the very development of agriculture and a recognition that there's really a difference in how that plays out in the developing world versus post-industrial settings.
It's different. It's a different thing in the developing world. In the developing world, the major advantages of people moving to town is they stop being subsistence farmers, which is ecologically probably the most harmful thing that people do, because it's typically on poor agricultural land. People beat themselves bloody trying to get food out of that land. They're not in the cash economy, so they're stuck there. It's a poverty trap. And as soon as they go join their uncle in town and leave the subsistence farm behind, typically nobody tries to take it over, especially in the tropics. It grows back very rapidly. The animals that are wild animals that are not being trapped and shot for food anymore come back. And so there's a whole lot of recovery going on throughout the developing world, just of people moving to town and the countryside coming back behind them.
What do people usually mean when they say something's against nature?
As near as I can tell, when people say something is against nature, they mean it's something that happened since they were born. Agriculture across the board is so against nature, it takes my ecological breath away. We've over the thousands of years and decades with hybrids and so on, created these tremendously bizarre and fragile vegetables, corn and things that can't even reproduce without us helping them. It somehow, people got to calling that natural food. There are natural foods. Wild mushrooms is a natural food. And unfortunately, wild fish is a natural food, and we're killing way too many of them. Mariculture and aquaculture is a way better way to raise fish flesh. So when people say against nature, they're usually talking about something recent. But that may be shifting. Because what I'm seeing is a kind of a legacy resistance against GMOs, transgenic crops. I'm seeing a legacy resistance against nuclear.
What do you mean by legacy resistance?
Just that people have been fighting these things for a long time. This is what they know how to fight, and why change? But new stuff coming along, like synthetic biology, like Craig Venter basically doing a completely synthetic computer-driven genome and putting it in a cell and changing the species of that cell, which then went on to reproduce and become this new cell with various people's names in it and some quotes and things like that and the so-called watermarks in the genome. 30 years ago, I think environmentalists would have gone bananas over that and just said, this is, you know, this is an abomination, this is against nature, this is blame God, this is all those things we used to say. But this time around, I think people realized that a lot of this stuff we're already glad of. We're glad of transgenic engineering because a whole lot of our medicine is made that way. And I think people are getting a sense that much more nutritious food and medically useful food is coming along through this technology very shortly, at which point I think you will see the resistance to genetically engineered crops disappear in a matter of months. And I keep predicting, I love organic farming, and used to be friends with Bob Rodale until he died. And
Who is Bob Rodale?
Back in Emmaus, Pennsylvania is the source of all organic farming and gardening thinking. And in the 60s, the Whole Earth Catalog celebrated them, and I'm told they took off partly because we celebrated them. So I got to be friends with the second generation Rodale, Bob Rodale, who later died absurdly in a taxi accident in Russia. But in any case, I think organic farming is great because, most especially because it keeps pesticides out of the environment. I think pesticides are one of the most harmful things we do with agriculture. And there's somewhat less herbicides and somewhat less fertilizer, and all that's good. But as these healthier foods come along that are engineered, as long as organic people say, well, we're not going to have any engineered crops, they're going to wind up trying to sell less healthy food at a higher price. which is part of the organic deal, is you pay extra for, you know, some kind of premium you're supposed to assume is there.
But you buy organic food, but for a different reason than most people,
I buy organic food mainly because it means, it's sort of a public service. It means less pesticides in the environment. Less pesticides means more bugs means more birds, you know, the whole food web stays alive when you have less pesticides out there.
You don't think there's any taste difference, though?
By and large, there's no way to show that organic produce is any more nutritious or any more delicious or, you know, all those things that we imagine are great. It's certainly the case that when you grow your own vegetables, which my wife does, and they are fabulous, and as it happens, we do it organically, and so we got lots of birds as well, that's as good as food gets. And the whole artisanal food, local food, all that kind of thing, farmers markets, all that's great stuff. But it actually doesn't matter in terms of the things you might care about, except price, whether the food you get at the farmers market is organic or not. Typically, the organic will cost more because it costs more to farm that way.
There's a deadly dozen that email that goes around that said, these are the ones that you really have to buy organic. There's some that... You like cucumbers have pretty thick skin, so don't waste your money on organic cucumbers. But a tomato or berries or things that have very thin skins, that are the fruit is absorbing the pesticides. I guess fruit pickers, strawberry pickers, a lot of them have to wear hazmat suits when they're going in there because the amount of pesticides in there. So it's you'd think that those tastes, you can only wash so much of this out.
You take it case by case, vegetable by vegetable, industry by industry, region by region, and have as good testing of all these things in terms of what's coming in on the food as you can. But it's also worth bearing in mind that fruits and vegetables are full of toxins on purpose in terms of the plants. That's how they protect themselves. And so part of what we've done by domesticating these plants is try to reduce that to a tolerable level. But, you know, green potatoes will kill rats when they eat them. Good organic green potatoes will kill rats. So don't eat a green potato. Cassava, you know, one of the staples for millions and millions of people in Africa, has a lot of cyanide in it. And if you happen to be suffering from malnutrition, you're much more susceptible to that cyanide. And that's the reason a really superb engineered version of cassava that's coming along has no cyanide in it. It also has protein, which cassava doesn't. It has precursors for vitamin A, like golden rice, which is fabulously important in the developing world. And that kind of thing is moving forward mainly now in the developing world, but I think people are going to catch on pretty quickly. Why should just Asians eat golden rice when it's that good for you?
Cost of living gets so high, rich and poor, they start to cry. Now the weak must get strong, they say, oh, what a tribulation. Them belly full, but we hungry. Hungry mob is a hungry mob. A rain or fall, but a dirty tough. A pot of yoke, but you not enough. We're gonna chuck to jam music. Chucking. Hey, we're chucking to jam music. We're chucking.
You're listening to Sea Change Radio. This is part two of our two-part series with Stuart Brand, American writer, merry prankster, and environmentalist. One of the fears that people have with genetic engineered crops in the developing world is the role of multinational corporations who have an obligation to their shareholders and are much more worried about profits than making sure that people who otherwise weren't being well fed or getting fed, but you
have a mixed take on that. One is, I'm not sure why we're so unhappy with the corporations in this particular subject area when we basically pay no attention to big pharma, which is even bigger.
And well,
with
aren't
more
they
egregious
linked?
Profits in their, you know, engineering our medicines and the medicines that we're selling to the world. And for some reason, that's not on anybody's radar or something to be upset about. The other thing mainly that's going on is in the developing world, they are proceeding with their own biotechnology. And so in the Philippines, the International Rice Institute, in China, which is moving ahead full bore with a multi-billion dollar program to go ahead with biotech on their own. They may bear relation to Monsanto, but they don't need Monsanto. Likewise in India, likewise in Africa, likewise in all the universities of the world that have biotech programs. These things are either outside the corporations or bear a arm's length relation with many of the corporations. And it's about to come to the garden shed. People are always inventing new kinds of roses and always inventing new kinds of snakes and salamanders and lizards, as it turns out. I didn't know this was the case, but there's a whole world of people who breed exotic lizards. And you know this technology is going to come to, it's pretty inexpensive, it's pretty doable once you learn how to do it, and people are going to be growing. We already have blue roses, the thing which was famously impossible to do with breeding, and everybody tried for centuries, and Kipling wrote a poem about it and so on. There's now blue rose you can buy from Japan, it's engineered. And they used some genes from petunias or something like that.
They got square watermelons too, yeah, that you can stack.
Well, yeah, whatever happened to the square watermelons?
Didn't take off like I
that
thought it
probably
would. I thought that was a good idea, actually.
Grown in boxes up there on that one. In any case, the engineering stuff is really normal agriculture and really normal biology. I think that's what the two chapters I have in Whole Earth Discipline about this are trying to say, is the various things that we sort of frighten ourselves about. There's going to be super weeds. Well, we've always had super weeds. It's what happens when you use any, you know, single kind of way to head off weeds. And the very, you know, there's going to be surprises genetically. Well, yeah, that happens all the time. And one of the great advantages with genetic engineering is you're not just messing around with traits and wondering what genes are behind them. Now you're actually, you know what the genes are behind the traits you care about. You're working with the genes. And so it's actually a great deal more transparent, a great deal safer in terms of, you know, unwanted side effects or whatever, because you know exactly what's going on in the genome of the plant that you care about. So this is just a case where the science and the engineering is going way deeper, which gives us way better knowledge, which gives us a much better chance to know what's really going on. And likewise, medicine is moving forward. So we're finding out which things are actually harmful to us and what things we're maybe worried about that are not so harmful.
And you also believe that there's a lot of positive outcomes that can come from the non-governmental organizations spreading some of the know-how and seeds related to this kind of new generation of farming, right?
A good example of that is what happened with the papaya. Papaya is too small a crop for large corporations to really consider it sort of worth spending time on. It's like an orphan disease, and you know, big medicine won't spend time on it. But the people who have that disease in their family are horrified. Well, Hawaii was horrified to be losing their entire papaya crop to a thing called the ringworm virus. And basically, it was going to shut down the entire industry in Hawaii. And a scientist at the University of Hawaii figured out a way to basically inoculate the plant with some genes from the virus. And so there's now a virus-resistant papaya. This was done without any involvement from corporations at all, without any big hassle from environmentalists, because people in Hawaii knew how much of their populace was dependent on papaya, not just for food they eat, but for the ones that were growing it. And they got the local senators and so on, got it through the very long and arduous process in Washington of getting permits for these engineered papayas. It's much longer than for anything that you create by breeding. And anyway, they got it through. They saved the papaya industry. All the papayas we eat here in California are almost certainly grown in Hawaii and are one of two varieties engineered. It's taking off in Asia. And it's a great story of really intelligent, rapid use of genetic engineering to save a crop without any involvement by corporations at all.
You quote Freeman Dyson on his theory of open source biology. Can you tell us a little bit about how that
works?
Well,
open source biology is probably going to be the reality in any case, as it is now in you know, people gardening and just you know trying to crossbreed all kinds of weird things. And as the technology to identify traits in the genes that drive them comes to people's kitchens and garden sheds, garages, they will use it to generate rutabagas of a new and different color for fun, and then maybe with new health benefits or amazing tastes. Or I mean, we've been doing this for a long time. The kiwi is a created fruit. First of all, it wasn't created in New Zealand. They just took it on as something that they rebranded. It's the Chinese gooseberry, and created by normal intense breeding. And by the way, one should know that most important agricultural breeding now, a lot of it is accelerated by exposing the seeds to severe radiation, which then you just blast these things with radiation and then grow up whatever comes up, and it's all sorts of weird stuff, and you go picking your way among the weird stuff to see if by chance any of those things are a little better than what you had before from your standpoint. But so a lot of the organic vegetables and fruits we eat were created by irradiating the hell out of seeds and driving them crazy, and they came up crazy, and some of that crazy we thought was kind of great. So we already do that kind of thing, and it's much less precise than engineering, because you really are blasting these things and hoping for the best. And one might wonder what happens to the things that don't get picked, that are weird in some way that maybe we would be worried about. Actually, I don't know the answer to that. An investigation is called for.
They were hiding behind hay bales. They were planting in the full moon. They had given all they had for something new. See the thrashers coming, and the water shone like diamonds in the dew. And I was just getting up, hit the road before it's light, trying to catch an hour on the
sun. When I saw those thrashers rolling by, looking more than two lanes wide, I was feeling like my day had just begun.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is Stuart Brand. This is the second part of our two-part discussion with Stuart. Please visit our archives at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to listen to part one of the discussion where we talk about Stuart's position on nuclear energy. You're a little more sanguine about the role of these large multinational corporations in the spreading of GE crops.
I will bust Monsanto for some stuff that I'm concerned about, which is different than the usual environmental critique. I do not like that Monsanto and some of the other companies, but Monsanto more than others, and it's one of the reasons they're getting more and more competition from Syngenta, DuPont, and some of the others. Monsanto won't let researchers do research on their seeds. So you can buy some seeds from Monsanto, and if you want to grow them and compare them to something, just doing ordinary science in the biology department somewhere, they forbid that. I think that sucks. Likewise, in many cases, they will license a technology that some university department has developed that is basically a research technology, ways to actually do some of this engineering in a research way, and then will not license those techniques to people to do that research. So they basically are suffocating research by that kind of practice. I find both of those pretty despicable. Now, something environmentalists like to get, some anti-GM people like to get worked up about is the requirement that Monsanto and some of the others put on that you can't keep the seeds and plant them the next year. Well, almost no farmers keep seeds from last year and plant them next year. And mostly, and same is true in most people's gardens. We like hybrid vigor, so we buy hybrid corn and hybrid cauliflower and various things. And those don't seed anyway. You get chaos if you try to keep the seeds.
Why have they pushed forward with the number of lawsuits that they have in terms of patent infringement in that
they
sense?
They have done it because, unfortunately, these seeds, from their standpoint, breed true. And indeed, some of the stuff that's going forward in the developing world, one of the things that's being encouraged is that people get golden rice, for example, which does breed true, and then plant it themselves. So the corporate guys saying you've got to buy new seed from us every year, that's an issue between a supplier and their customers. And to imagine that somehow the farmers can't sort that out on their own is imagining that farmers don't know what's going on. And boy, is that never the case. And it's one of the reasons that Monsanto is getting serious competition, even in the engineered crops, from other companies who are perhaps less stringent in their requirements. But this is, this is a customer relations thing. And for us to worry about any farmer, there's talk about these corporations are enslaving these farmers. So the minute they don't want to plant BT corn from Monsanto, they just don't buy it next year.
Well, that's in America, but you talk about the BT cotton crop in India exploding and that leading to a lot higher productivity levels in the cotton industry there. But there's also, from the small farmers' perspective, in places in India where they've have narrower choices in terms of who to buy from. Yes, maybe there's some competition, but then prices can go 3-4 times higher for the seeds. And I mean, when you see they don't have a very mature banking system, so then they end up taking out money for next year's crop. If they have a bad year, you see skyrocketing bankruptcies, and there's
suicides that go with that.
Documented so on, right? High suicide rates and stuff. So, I mean, there's downsides.
The suicide rate is definitely an important thing. As more and more parts of India get into the cash crop business, they're learning that cash crop, the whole cash crop world, whether or not it's engineered, has things like really bad loan sharks who get really nasty. And so they're going through that phase. But there's a wonderful India story that I came across after I finished Whole Earth Discipline that I will impart now from a book called Hybrid. And apparently what happened, it's the history of breeding, basically, in agricultural crops.
Who's it by?
The book is called Hybrid, The History and Science of Plant Breeding by Noel Kingsbury. And right at the end of the book, he tells about some stuff that happened in India that I didn't know about. So here it is. It's the 1990s. Monsanto, Maycomb, local joint company, is starting to plant field trials of BT cotton. And Vandana Shiva is, you know, raising her usual ruckus that these are seeds of suicide, seeds of slavery, and so on. But some of the plants are disappearing from these field trials. And it turns out there comes to be a whole, refers to it as anarcho-capitalist economy. The local, and then not so local, cotton farmers love the idea of caterpillar-proof cotton. They also have their own land races of cotton that are well suited to the local situation, the local weather, local, you know, what people like in their cotton and so on. And so they breed these stolen Monsanto BT cottons with their own, and suddenly there's taking off dozens and then scores of different genetically engineered land races. And by the early 2000s, there was 250 million acres of India planted in outlaw cotton, twice as much as was planted under the Monsanto label. And it was the world's first case of GM land races, and it's completely done by people who are not paying attention to Monsanto or Vandana Shiva, or just trying to get better cotton.
And you think that, I can't remember the crop, but once the patent can run out, then the rest of the world can really benefit from it.
This is also the case, and this happens pretty regularly. So one of the best herbicides, and I give Monsanto credit here, one of the very best herbicides invented in recent decades was glyphosate, what they call Roundup. And it came out of patent in, I think, 2002, and the price of glyphosate instantly fell in half and then lower than that. It's one of the reasons it took off across the world as a very popular herbicide, which from my environmental standpoint is good news because it is much less long-lasting in the soil and in the water than most other herbicides, less toxic and very, very effective. Now, of course, if you use just glyphosate, you will eventually get some glyphosate-tolerant weeds, which is a problem for the farmer. It's not a problem for the natural environment because a glyphosate-tolerant weed has no particular advantage out in the woods. As I say, it's like a boxer in a gunfight. You know, you're very, very skilled at something that is of no use to you in the current situation. But it is a problem for the farmers. And so then you, there are other herbicides. You can stack in resistance to dicamba along with the glyphosate resistance, or you can do the other things that any integrated pest and weed management system will do with timing and all the rest of it. The main advantage for as far as I'm concerned with the herbicide tolerant plants is it lets people stop plowing, and so you get no-till agriculture with Roundup Ready soybeans, for example, and the other versions of glyphosate tolerant soybeans. And when you stop plowing, that's extremely good news for the atmosphere and fantastic news for the soil, and so you get soil getting richer and richer and richer just because people are using these higher tech beans.
Stuart Brand, the author of Whole Earth Discipline and a great thinker and one of our national treasures. Thank you for joining us on Sea Change Radio.
Well, thank you for having me along.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio.
Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Eddie Harris, Bob Marley and the Wailers, and Neil Young.
And special thanks to Stuart Brand.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.